definition, what does it tell us about the Mahayana view of the nature of the Buddha?
Okay, now here again, this is a question that has, it requires two things. It requires, one, that you remember the parable of the wise physician, and two, that you can explain what it tells us about the nature of the Buddha. Not really a very difficult question if you read the excerpt, if you read the parable of the wise physician, and if you read the chapter on the Lotus Sutra and the Tree of Enlightenment, it should not be a difficult question. So, first of all, let someone tell me, see if someone can tell me the parable of the wise physician. Okay, yeah, and basically that's correct, yes. I mean, there's a wise physician. He happens to be away on business. He comes back and finds that his sons have taken poison and they're ill. And so he compounds a medicine to cure them of their illness. And the medicine is perfectly capable of curing them of their illness. Some of them take the medicine and are immediately cured, but some of them are so deranged, so delirious, they're out of their minds because of the effects of the poison, so they refuse to take the medicine. So at that point, the skillful physician, he thinks of, again, an expedient means, a skillful means, and he tells the sons, well, I have to go away, I'm getting old, but there's one more thing I have to take care of, so I have to go away, but I'm keeping this medicine here for you. And then he goes away and sends back a message that he has died. And then his sons are all very upset. They think that, oh, if my father were here, if our father were here, he would help us, he would cure us. But now he has abandoned us and he has gone off and died in some foreign country. And so they're very upset. But then they remember that, well, he did leave this medicine for us, so maybe we should take this medicine. So they take the medicine and they're cured. And after they're cured, then the father returns and they're all reunited. So it is a skillful means, an expedient device that the father, the skillful physician, uses to get his sons to take the medicine. Because when his sons believe that he is dead and he can no longer help them, then the only thing they have is the medicine. So they take the medicine and they are cured. That's the story. That's the parable. Now, why? I mean, what is the point of it? What does this tell us about the Mahayana view of the Buddha? So this is now the more difficult part of the question, because you have to interpret the parable. But the sutra gives you, of course, the sutra tells you very clearly what the parable means. Okay, but that's a little bit too general. Can someone be a little bit more specific? What does it tell us about the Buddha, the nature of the Buddha? What specifically, what does this parable teach? I mean, you just need to read the excerpt, you know, the chapter 16.
Everybody could be saved, that means we can jump out
Yes, yes, that's all correct. But
I think the main point is that Lord Buddha felt that if he's there all the while, then the people would not feel would not be inclined to love. Spiritual progress. So if the people thought that Lord Buddha is one, then they'll speed up their spiritual development.
Yeah, now we're getting there. Now we're getting closer. Look at the title of the chapter. The title of the chapter. What is the title of the chapter? The title of the chapter is The Lifespan of the Tathagata. So, you know, this parable is supposed to show that the extinction of the Buddha was just a skillful means, just an expedient means. That when the physician goes off to a foreign country and sends back a message saying that he's dead, that this is like the Buddha appearing to enter Parinirvana, the Buddha Shakyamuni appearing to enter Parinirvana. But the Buddha Shakyamuni never really enters Parinirvana. The Buddha Shakyamuni is always here. But he uses this expedient means, this skillful device of appearing to enter Parinirvana in order to encourage those people who otherwise might get lazy and might not practice because they would think that, well, the Buddha is here all the time. Anytime we can go and see the Buddha. You know, it's not so difficult to imagine how this works in terms of human psychology. Suppose you have a very great master, everyone says this is a very great master, and he lives just in a neighboring town, then you think, all right, I don't have to go and see him this week. This week I'm quite busy. I have some important business to take care of, or I have some relatives visiting. I'll go and see the master next week. And then the next week maybe you catch a cold and you say, oh, I have a cold this week. I won't go and see the master this week. And so you keep on putting it off because the master is just around the corner, no? It's also like living... I'm sure that people who live near the Taj Mahal, they don't think about going to visit the Taj Mahal. You know, people who live near Borobudur, they don't think about going to visit Borobudur. They're just getting on with their lives. It's for people far away who make the effort to go to Borobudur or to go to Bodh Gaya or whatever. So this disappearance, this passing into Parinirvana of the Buddha, is just a device to get people to practice, because then they think, well, now we're on our own. We better practice the Dharma, we better take this medicine, because that's all we've got. And that's what the Buddha tells us, actually. If you look at the text of the Mahaparinirvana Sutta in the Pali Canon, it couldn't be written better to suit the picture that is painted in the Lotus Sutra, in the sense that the Buddha says, well, now I'm going to enter Parinirvana. And Ananda says, well, isn't there anything that you want to... Isn't there something you can give to the monks, to the Sangha? Sangha, any sort of last instructions that you want to give to the Sangha? And the Buddha says, what? What does the Sangha want of me? I've given them the Dharma. They don't need anything else. I've left the medicine. What do you want from me now? You know? And so the point is, the passing into extinction from the Mahayana point of view is just a skillful device. The Buddha was never really, you know, the Shakyamuni, his birth, his struggle, his attainment of enlightenment, this was just all skillful means. And especially the entering into Parinirvana was skillful means, because the Buddha never really enters extinction. So that's the point of the parable. All whatever else all of you said is correct, but don't overlook the principal point, because the question is, what does this parable tell you about the Mahayana view of the Buddha? And what the parable tells you about the Mahayana view of the Buddha is that the Buddha is not just the Buddha Shakyamuni, who after 80 years passed away into Parinirvana, entered extinction. That's not the real nature of the Buddha. The real nature of the Buddha is eternal. His lifespan is incalculable. His passing into Parinirvana was just an expedient means, just a skillful means. So that's what the parable tells you about the Mahayana view of the Buddha. So although everything else that you said is correct, don't leave out this crucial point.
Yes. If we reverse the thought of this and put it in a positive way, that the Buddha is still with us and that this is another part of the teaching, and that will be an inspiration for all Buddhists to practice sadhana.
Sure, sure. Everything, every text, every teaching, every utterance of the Buddha, whether it be in a Mahayana text or a Theravada text, is all just, and it says so, it says that in the Lotus Sutra, it's all just for the purpose of liberation. And that means that it's all just a raft, it's all just for the purpose of crossing over. So it's, don't take any of this literally. Don't take any of this, don't hold on to any of this. Just use it, you know, take advantage of it, allow it to benefit you like medicine. Don't hold on to the medicine. Don't keep taking the medicine once you're cured. All of this is just so much skillful means. It's all just so much words designed to benefit different living beings according to their state of mind. Some people, they are quite content to think that the Buddha has passed into extinction. They will practice the Dharma. They will not have any difficulty with that. Other people, as you say, will be encouraged by believing that the Buddha is still with us. So of course all of this is all relative. Anything that you put into words is relative. You know, you say the Buddha is not eternal. The Buddha is not non-eternal. I mean, this is, you know, he's beyond existence and non-existence. So in a sense, even when we say that the Buddha exists, the Buddha still exists, that's also an extreme, because the real Buddha is beyond existence and non-existence. You can't say that the Buddha really exists or that the Buddha really doesn't exist. Even when the Buddha was walking around in Magadha, you couldn't say even then that he really existed or he really didn't exist. You can't say that any of us really exist or really don't exist. We appear, we're all like phantoms in a dream. We're all like magically created beings. We appear, we walk around, we talk, but are we really existent? No, because if you try to pin us down, if you try to find our essence, if you try to find our substance, you can't find it. And we also disappear. We can disappear at any moment. I will disappear tomorrow morning. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're not existent and we're not non-existent. These categories don't apply. These categories only get us into trouble. This exists, that doesn't exist, you know? We go around, oh, this exists, that doesn't exist, this exists, that doesn't exist. And so we're always just, you know, I mean, like a seesaw, you know? This exists, that doesn't exist. And we never rest. We never get peace. Why? Because we're always concerned about what exists and what doesn't exist. Forget about what exists and what doesn't exist. Just let it be. Okay, I don't want to, I mean, we're reviewing questions here. I don't want to.
What is the principal theme of the Heart Sutra? Discuss it with reference to the Abhidharma analysis of reality.
Yes, the first part of the question is straightforward enough, and you have just answered it. The principal theme of the Heart Sutra is shunyata, or emptiness. I don't think anyone can make any mistake about that. I don't know how many times the term emptiness occurs in the sutra, but certainly the principal theme of the Heart Sutra is emptiness, just as the principal theme of all the Prajnaparamita Sutras are really is really emptiness. But you know, it's curious, for example, in the Vajracchedika, you don't see emptiness occurring very often. Emptiness there is arrived at through a negation. In the Heart Sutra, instead, emptiness is very much in the foreground, and emptiness is mentioned many, many times. So, okay, the principle theme of the Heart Sutra is emptiness. Now, the second part of the question is a little bit more difficult, but not so difficult, I think. Discuss it with reference to the Abhidhamic background. So, what does anyone have any idea what this means, what this might refer to? Yes, okay, very good. Yes. And? Well, dependent origination is not actually mentioned in the Heart Sutra, you know, although it's sort of there in the background. But I'm thinking more of, yes, of course, you know, because look at the list. You know, look at the list of element. Look at the list of things that the sutra declares as being empty. What are the things that it declares as being empty? It's the five aggregates and the 18 dhatu. No, so it basically just goes right down the list of the major Abhidhamic categories, the five aggregates and the 18 elements of experience, and it says, you know, these are all empty, and in emptiness these do not exist. And then, of course, you have some other references to what we might call some of the fundamental teachings of Buddhism, like the Four Noble Truths, like origination and destruction and so forth. So these are not strictly Abhidhamic in character. But certainly the categorization, the classification into experience, into the five aggregates and the 18 dhatu, you know, this is very, very typically Abhidhamic, and the sutra specifically declares that they're all empty and that they don't exist in emptiness. So I think you need to mention these two points. And because the question is quite simple, really, so you need to... you need to give me the examples. You need to say, you know, form, feeling, list the five aggregates, list the 18 dhatus. You can even talk about, you can even tell me how we arrive at the 18 dhatus. Why do we have these 18 dhatus? You know, I suppose, why we have these 18 dhatus? Why we have these 18 and not another 18, or another 20, or another 5, or whatever. Where do we get these 18? 6 times 3. Right. Contact, you have each ayatana, you have 3 elements, right? You have the sense faculty, the object, and the mind, and the consciousness. So, okay, so you just need to spell that out. Main theme is emptiness, and it's In the first instance, it's directed toward the Abhidharmic analysis of, I said reality here, it's the Abhidharmic analysis of personal experience, or the Abhidharmic analysis of, well, reality is okay too, because, I mean, I tend to call it personal experience. But anyway, I think you shouldn't have any problem really with this question. So let's go on to the
next Heart Sutra declares, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Discuss the implications of this statement.
Okay, I mean, now this, all right, well, someone can begin, perhaps. Does anyone want to begin? Someone asked me about this the other day. Yes, that's correct, and that's more or less what I said when someone asked me about this the other day. I said that the meaning is that emptiness is form, form is emptiness, that they are not different, that everything that exists, everything that we perceive, you know, cups, microphones, tables, cards, and so forth, and houses, and the world around us, all these forms are at the same time empty. Their real nature is emptiness. It's not that emptiness is something different from form, but that emptiness is something somewhere high above us or somewhere on one side, that form and emptiness are identical, that they, forms are both forms and they are at the same time they're emptiness, and emptiness is empty but it is also form. And the same thing is true of feeling, perception, volition, etc., the five aggregates. All of this is both volition and emptiness. Emptiness is also volition. So this is the first step. I'm sorry, in fact, when whoever asked me the question the other day, this is as much of an answer as I gave. There are further implications of this, and the further implications are the identity of samsara and nirvana. And I talked about how the Heart Sutra indirectly indicates the non-difference or the identity of samsara and nirvana when it rejects origination and destruction. When the Heart Sutra says there's no origination and there's no cessation, if there's no origination and no cessation, then there's no conditioned world. And if there's no conditioned world, there's no non-conditioned world, there's no nirvana. So there's no samsara and no nirvana, or to put it another way, samsara and nirvana are identical. There's no difference between samsara and nirvana. If you see things in terms of forms, you see things in terms of objects, you see things in terms of cause and effect and so forth, then you see samsara. If you see things in terms of emptiness, if you see things as not linked up in the causal chain, in the chain of interdependent origination, then you see things as nirvana. But this is also suggested, quite strongly implicated, in the statement form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Because in a sense, emptiness is another word for nirvana. Nirvana is beyond existence and non-existence, identity and difference, the knower and the known, all of these categories. Are not applicable to nirvana. And similarly, emptiness is beyond existence and non-existence. Emptiness is the end of all views. Emptiness is not really anything in itself. It cannot be grasped. Cannot hold on to emptiness, etc. It is the nirvanic characteristic. The characteristic of nirvana is emptiness. So in a sense, when you say form is emptiness, it means form is nirvana, feeling is nirvana. All of these things are actually nirvana. Nirvana is not different from the phenomenal world, and the phenomenal world is not different from nirvana. So this statement also implies the identity of samsara and nirvana. I probably won't give you this question. This is a little bit difficult, perhaps.
What is meant by emptiness? Is it a metaphysical principle? Discuss.
Okay. Well, this one I'd like you to try. I'd like you to have a go at this one. What is emptiness anyway? I mean, what is, you know? Yes. Well, I'm not so sure. I mean that is a good, you know, teaching, but I'm reminded of the two verses by Shinshu and Wei Nung. Shinshu wrote a verse saying, the body is a Bodhi tree, the mind is a mirror bright. Daily we clean it so that no dust can alight. And that was a very good teaching, that was a very good verse. But then Wei Nung wrote, Bodhi has got nothing to do with trees. There is no mirror. Since from the beginning everything was emptiness, where could dust alight? So, did you follow? I mean, I don't know if you follow this or not. You know what I'm talking about? The succession, the sixth patriarch, Wei Nung, the verse that he wrote in rebuttal to the verse of the other candidate. Anyway, never mind, I don't want to... it also probably is completely unheard of by our Theravada friends, so I don't suppose that I should pursue it. Well, let me put it this way. I mean, what is emptiness? The question here is emptiness some sort of, and in fact, in the notes I say, what is emptiness? It's not a metaphysical principle. One of our friends here the other day was asking whether emptiness was a metaphysical principle. It's not a metaphysical principle. People mistake it to be a metaphysical principle because they think, oh, this emptiness thing is very high and very deep. I don't know how something can be high and deep at the same time, but I suppose, you know, anything is possible with emptiness. No, it's not really. It's not a metaphysical empty. It's not a metaphysical entity. What it is it's a teaching device. It's a corrective. It's like medicine. And what is it medicine for? It's medicine for believing in the independent existence of things. So you see, as I was saying a moment ago, we are all constantly being jerked this way and that way, and this way and that way by existence and non-existence. This exists, that doesn't exist. We're like, you know, a puppet on a string, and existence and non-existence are pulling us in opposite directions. That's why we're always getting pulled apart, and we never feel comfortable, because we're being torn apart by our obsession with existence and non-existence. Now, emptiness is supposed to get us over this problem of existence and non-existence. And the way we do that is by seeing that things don't have any self-existence, that they don't really exist, and they're also not really non-existent. I repeated this a number of times. From the fact that things appear, they're not non-existent. So because all these things are here, you know, I can touch, I can feel, I can smell, I can, you know, whatever, all of these things. So they're not non-existent. It would be stupid, it would be absurd to claim that all these things are non-existent. But it's equally stupid and absurd to claim that they're existent, because they're just here for the moment. They're not here permanently, they're not going to be around. So they're going to disappear, they're going to be destroyed. So the fact is emptiness. Because things appear, they're not non-existent. Because things come to an end, they're not existent. So they have a kind of dreamlike status. They have a kind of magical type of reality, a kind of half-reality. They're half here, they're half not here. They're only shadows, they're only reflections. This is why the reflection imagery is so common. Also the imagery of the magically created show, the magically created elephant, or the image of the mirage, the simile of the mirage. So what emptiness is supposed to do is it's supposed to get rid of this idea that things exist in their own right, that anything in this world has a real solid existence. I mean, what? These cards that I have here with me, what, these have a solid existence? No, they're not solid. Just tear them up. I'll burn them. What happened to the cards? They don't exist. They don't have any solid existence. You know? So the fact is, everything is like that. And emptiness is supposed to point that out. And emptiness is only a code word, you know, it's a code word for interdependent existence. It's a code word for pratitya samuppada hridaya, for pratitya samuppada. It's a code word for that. Last night someone asked me if the Mahayana has pratitya samuppada. Yeah, definitely. Pratitya samuppada is the heart of the Mahayana in many ways. And emptiness is just a code word for pratitya samuppada. Everything that exists, everything that originates dependently is empty. Why? Because it doesn't stand by itself. It doesn't exist by itself. It depends upon other things. And it doesn't have swabhava, it doesn't have self-existence, and it also doesn't have parabhava. It doesn't exist by virtue of something else, because nothing can exist by virtue of something else, because then its existence would be borrowed. It wouldn't be its own existence, it would be the existence that it borrows from something else. Just like the existence of the flame and the oil lamp is borrowed from the wick and the oil. It doesn't have any existence of its own. So all things are like that. And the point of emptiness is to show us that all things don't have any self-existence, that all things are like shadows, all things are like dreams, all things are like a mirage. And that's the point of emptiness, to teach us that. And once we learn that, then we also need to understand that emptiness is also just, it doesn't have any self-existence. Emptiness only exists in relation to substance, to what is non-empty. But since there really isn't anything non-empty, there's really nothing empty either. There's no emptiness, emptiness of emptiness. Emptiness is also empty. Emptiness is also interdependently originated. Doesn't have a self-existence. So that's why we say emptiness is like a medicine. Emptiness is a teaching device. Emptiness is not an entity. Nagarjuna says those people who hold on to emptiness, they are completely misguided. They are beyond help. You know? So it's not anything to hold on to. It's just a method, it's just a way of pointing out that everything is interdependent, everything is conditioned, things exist because of conditions, and that they are neither really existent nor non-existent, which is another expression of the middle way of the Buddha, because the Buddha, when he taught the middle way, he didn't mean only avoiding indulgence and luxury. The Buddha, when he taught the middle way, meant a lot of things, and you can see in the Kacchayana Gota Sutta that the Buddha also meant by the middle way avoiding existence and non-existence. So that's why we say emptiness, interdependent origination, and the middle way, they're all the same thing. They're all the same thing. They're identical in import. Okay, so I think I've taken care of that question. I hope so. Okay, so should we?
Can I interrupt?
Oh, by all means, please.
So, once we get out of samsara and we aim at nibbana, so there's nothing there.
Why you have to go back to existence and non-existence? Why you have to go back to something and nothing? You know, this nirvana is beyond existence and non-existence. How many times does the Buddha have to say, the Tathagata after death neither exists nor does not exist? You know, the Tathagata after death, he cannot say he exists, he cannot say he does not exist. We're trying to get away from this, you know, we keep falling into the same old trap, you know. You can't talk about nirvana or the ultimate as being existent. You can't talk about it as being nothing. You can't talk about it as being non-existent. It's something which is completely beyond our categories, you know? Everybody knows. The other day when I asked you if you knew the story of the turtle and the fish, you all said, yes, yes, we know the story. You know the story. Do you know the meaning? What does it mean? It means that the fish can't begin to understand what it's like to be walking around on dry land, just like we can't begin to understand what nirvana is like. We have to get over there, we have to attain nirvana, we have to clear our minds, get all the cobwebs out of our heads, out of our hearts, you know, whichever location for consciousness you prefer. We have to get all the cobwebs, all the divisions, all the lines that we draw, existent, non-existent, samsara, nirvana. When we get rid of all those things, then we will be able to experience a different kind of reality. You know, call it a parallel universe, call it, you know, something which is, as we say all the time about nirvana, you know, you cannot categorize nirvana. You cannot put a name, a label on nirvana. You can make some just general suggestions or indications, but don't please think that, you know, we're all practicing just to become nothing. You know, because if that's true, then we might as well just become ordinary materialists and just think that, well, when we die, we're nothing. We just go back to the earth. This is the materialistic view. You see, so, I mean, it's not correct to say or to think that the ultimate attainment is existent or non-existent or both or neither. This is the world. You're using worldly categories. You're using actually thought formations, mental formations that lead to the entrapment of living beings in samsara, which is exactly the opposite of what we want. We want to get out of samsara. What happened? Yeah. Okay, I equal the middle way. Yeah, well, it's all the same, actually. Yeah. I mean, shunyata, no entity exists, but shunyata, I was saying, last night I was saying to some of you, pratitya samutpada equals nisvabhava, equals shunyata, equals the middle way, you know, equals pratitya, equals madhyama pratipada.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
In Mahatmya also expressed this idea, yaspratita samutpada, sunyatantam tatatmai. The sunyatant pratita samutpada say, the other way say, the Mahatmya Patipada also say.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what I was quoting. I mean, that's what I had in mind when I put this, when I mentioned this. I mean, I had that. That's, what is it, 24:18 or something like that, no? In the Karika. Chapter 24, verse 18 or something like that.
What is the principal pedagogical device used in the Diamond Sutra? Give examples. What is the purpose of the device?
Okay, pedagogical, is that a problem for anyone? Pedagogical means teaching. You have to forgive me for using these academic words, but I'm just in the habit of doing it, I'm afraid. Okay, what is the principal teaching device used in the Diamond Sutra? Actually, the answer to that is right in the notes. I should answer myself.
Yes.
Okay. So principal pedagogical device used in the Diamond Sutra is paradox. What do we mean by paradox? We mean that the real practice of the Mahayana, the Bodhisattva who follows the real practice of the Mahayana, he liberates countless living beings, whatever kind of living beings they may be, whether they're born of eggs or whatever, or moisture and so on. He liberates all living beings, but he knows that all living beings, not one single living being is ever really liberated. This is paradox. He liberates all living beings, countless living beings, but really no living being is liberated. All living beings, no living beings. This is a paradox. It's a contradiction. It's a contradiction which we can call a paradox. How do we resolve this contradiction? Because from the conventional truth, from the point of view of conventional truth, the Bodhisattva vows to liberate all living beings. From the ultimate point of view, no living being is ever really liberated because there's no real living being. There's no ego, there's no personality, there's no substance, so there's no living being to liberate. There's also no Bodhisattva, incidentally. There's also no liberation. So from the ultimate point of view, there is no living being liberated. So this is an example of paradox. Similarly, the sutra says that a great accumulation of merit is really no merit. That's why it's a great accumulation of merit. Again, paradox. Great merit, no merit. Equivalence of great merit, no merit. How is it great merit, no merit? Because when it's merit that is achieved without attachment to objects, without attachment to the fruits, then it's great merit, but in that case it's no merit, but it's great merit, no merit, because it doesn't have any objective support. Similarly, the attainment of the Tathagata's attainment of enlightenment is really no attainment. That's why it's the attainment of enlightenment. So what happens in the whole body of the Diamond Sutra is that by using paradox, the sutra strives to teach the ultimate truth. The ultimate truth wherein there is no coming, no going, no staying, no this side, no that side, no attainment, no non-attainment, and so forth. So by contradicting, negating everything, merit, the Bodhisattva vow, all of these things which are based on dualities, based on this and that, on good and bad, on existence and non-existence, all of this is transcended. We have the ultimate truth that is beyond words and expressions. That's why we say the Buddha never taught anything to anyone, anywhere, that there is no teaching of the Dharma, because the truth is actually inexpressible. So whatever teaching is there, even if we call it ultimate truth, it's not really ultimate truth. It's just a pointer toward ultimate truth. It's just a finger pointing at the moon. It's not the moon itself.
What is the principal teaching of the Lankavatara Sutra? Discuss it with reference to the similes mentioned in the text.
Okay, well, the principal teaching of the Lankavatara Sutra is that everything is a manifestation of mind. This is the central doctrine of the text. And there are many, many similes in the text. You can begin with dream. Dream is a simile that occurs very, very often. You also have the other similes of imagined things. A flower growing in the sky, the circle of the whirling firebrand, the mirage, the magical show, an echo, a reflection. These are all things which have no substance. These are all things that are projected, that are seen by the mind, but that have no reality. But particularly dream. Dream is the best and the favorite analogy for the mentalist tradition, for the mind-only tradition, and for the Lankavatara Sutra. Dream is the favorite analogy, because in dream, you see a whole world and you believe it to be real, but in fact, when you wake up, you find that it wasn't real. So dream is the example, the supreme example, the best example, and you find it used also in other scholastic texts of the Yogacara school.
The Lankavatara Sutra refers to the analogy of the ocean, the wind, and the waves. Interpret the analogy with reference to the description of the evolution of the phenomenal world found in the text.
Okay, we have the analogy of the ocean, the wind, and the waves. The Alaya Vijnana, the store consciousness, is like the ocean. In its own original nature, it's calm and tranquil. The wind is the Klishta Manas, the afflicted mind, which is discrimination between subject and object. The afflicted mind is like the wind. It stirs up the surface of the ocean into waves. And the waves are like the six consciousnesses of everyday life, which are agitated and which result in the experience of samsara and the experience of birth and death. I'm cutting the answers a little bit short because we're running out of time.
Describe the system of eight consciousnesses. What is the role of the afflicted mind, Krishna Manas?
Okay, so in the Lankavatara Sutra and in the Yogacara school, we have a system of eight consciousnesses, the common six plus another two, the other two being the store consciousness, the Alaya Vijnana, and the afflicted mind, the Klishta Manas. Now, what happens in this case is that the, we have just in general described what happens when we talked about the analogy of the ocean, the wind, and the waves. The role of the afflicted consciousness is to disturb the peace. The role of the afflicted consciousness is to discriminate, to generate the subject-object duality, which creates the disturbance and the calm, on the calm surface of the storehouse consciousness of the ocean, and which results in the experience of the phenomenal world as we know it, with all its strife and all its stress and suffering and so forth.
What is the stored consciousness? Describe its role. Is it a soul? Depend your answer.
Okay, the stored consciousness is a consciousness which is originally pure, which is empty, which is also the repository of all the seeds of karma and sense experiences. The stored consciousness in that sense is the source which the afflicted mind draws upon to generate the phenomenal world. But the stored consciousness also, if we remove discrimination, if we remove the subject-object duality, and we, so to speak, purify the stored consciousness of discrimination and of the dirt of the afflictions, then the stored consciousness can give us Buddhahood. It can give us the experience of nirvana. It can give us the experience of the pure lands, and so forth. If the original purity of consciousness is revealed through cleansing, through practice, through the purification of the afflictions. So in this sense, the stored consciousness has a twofold role. On the one hand, it's the source of samsara. On the other hand, it can be the source of nirvana and Buddhahood. That's why we call it also the Buddha nature, or the Tathagata Garbha, the source of the Tathagatas. It isn't a soul because it isn't static, it's dynamic, it's always changing. So for this reason, it cannot be considered a soul like the soul of the Hindus.
What is meant by the Buddha nature, Tathagata Garbha? Discuss it with the help of examples and similes.
Well, I mean, what we mean by the Tathagata Garbha, or the Buddha nature, is that everyone has the potential to become a Buddha. And this potential is not realized because it is obscured or it is obstructed by the defilements and by the mental formations that we have accumulated as a result of our actions over countless lifetimes. We can use various examples like that of a jewel or that of gold or that of a cloth to describe the process of purification of the Buddha nature. So if we purify the mind, we clear it of afflictions in the same way that we would refine gold, or in the same way that we would polish a gem by removing the impurities, then the original mind, the Buddha nature, will shine forth in its own brilliance, with its own luminosity, with its own bright light, and the Buddha within us will be revealed as we clear away the afflictions, attachment, ignorance, aversion, and we replace them by compassion and wisdom and renunciation, detachment. So by replacing the afflictions with the Buddha qualities, we can turn the original mind from the mind of an ordinary sentient being to the mind of a Buddha, and that's why we refer to the original mind as the Buddha nature, as the potential to become a Buddha. We can make this mind of ours, which normally generates the suffering of samsara, with the right correctives, with the right practices to purify that mind, we can turn it into a Buddha, we can turn it into a Buddha mind, we can turn it into the experience of Buddhahood or of an advanced bodhisattva.
The last question. The Lotus Sutra, the Heart Sutra, and the Lankavatara Sutra represent three phases in the development of Mahayana philosophy. Describe and discuss the three phases.
Okay, just very briefly, I don't think I will give you this question either, but very briefly, just to conclude, what I have in mind here is that the Lotus Sutra is a popular text. It talks about the nature of the Buddha, and it emphasizes the transcendental nature of the Buddha. It sets forward the ideal of universal Buddhahood, or the idea that everyone can become a Buddha and everyone will eventually become a Buddha. So it's a text which is, if you like, it's a popular text. It's a text to popularize the Mahayana, to popularize the Bodhisattva ideal, to popularize the idea of universal Buddhahood. And it uses examples that illustrate the potential that everyone has to become a Buddha, the Buddha, the inherent or natural capacity that we all have to become Buddhas, to become enlightened ones. So it is a popular text. It's a text also that lends itself to devotion. There's a lot of things in the text that encourage devotion or reverence of the Buddha and so forth. It's not primarily a philosophical text. It's a religious text. It talks about the nature of the Buddha, and it puts forward a conception of the Buddha where the Buddha is supermundane, transcendental, eternal, supremely compassionate, exercises expedient means. The other two sutras that we studied belong to quite distinct phases. One belongs to the phase of the perfection of wisdom, where the principal idea is emptiness. The Lankavatara belongs to a phase where the principal idea is how this phenomenal world comes about. How is it that the phenomenal world appears? It appears because of the evolution of mind. It appears because of the activity of mental functions. And it is a manifestation of mind, and it discusses and describes how this phenomenal world develops from the basis of mind, from the source of mind, through various mental functions such as discrimination, imagination, and so forth. So these three texts have different objectives. One is to exalt the Buddha, to describe the Buddha in supernatural terms and supramundane terms, his transcendental nature, his inconceivable nature, his majesty, his great compassion, his use of expedient means, his ever-present activity to inspire all to strive for Buddhahood, to reassure everyone that they have the potential to become Buddhas. The perfection of wisdom discourses, the Prajnaparamita, this is to emphasize the teaching of emptiness, that nothing has any real existence, nothing has any ultimate existence. And then finally, in the Lankavatara, we have an example of a text that teaches the primacy of mind, that mind is the creator of the phenomenal universe, and it describes how mind creates the phenomenal universe. What are the processes? What are the mental functions that make it possible for the phenomenal world to appear from the source, out of the source of mind? So these are the three, these three sutras are quite different. They represent quite different aspects of Mahayana thought. So that's what I was referring to in this question. okay, children, so I'm going off now tomorrow. It's been a real pleasure to be able to be with you for these days. And even though I'm going to a far off country, I've left you my email, so you can always get in touch with me. Thank you.